Good evening, James McCanny here, March 26, 2009. And just to give you a preview of the main science topic, I will be talking about some esoteric science issues that have actually come to light recently, including general relativity. So before you turn off the dial, the general public, I'll try and cross, as I have learned how to do, cross the spectrum of people listening to this show. We've got people who are well advanced in the scientific world. There are people from all walks of life, and then there are people with potentially little formal education. But what I'll try and do is put this into perspective so that all of you with your varying backgrounds can understand this. So it touches on a lot of topics, and actually it affects your daily life more than what you might think. Anyway, the main science topic, I'll be talking about some of the history behind general relativity and go back to its very inception, and actually talk a little about Einstein himself. Einstein, through his later years, disagreed with his own theoretical work. And I'll make some quotes regarding that issue. But anyway, first, a few announcements. First of all, this past week, we had quite a major storm system, actually a couple of them, but one in particular that went through on the 24th, the 23rd and 24th of March, and these covered an area almost the size of the North American continent. You could see them on the worldwide weather satellite images, quickly rolling through the North American continent, primarily the United States and Canada, and extending all the way up into Canada, and all the way down into Mexico, northern Mexico. What's going on here? Well, Venus is starting to connect with Earth electrically. And, of course, I predicted this before. I said that March would be a typical March month. And, of course, we had a pretty severe winter storm in some areas of North America. And then we had severe flooding, especially up in the border states. There's an area that seems to flood quite a bit. It's the Red River Valley in northwestern Minnesota, northeastern North Dakota. And what's happened there is they've turned all of that land into farmland. And whether there were forests and basically prairie land up there previously, that would absorb the water, all of that has been turned into farmland, and so there was an estimate that I read where water that came down as rainfall would take 2 to 3 weeks to migrate down to the river basin when the prairie was there, when the trees were there. They converted that to farmland. Now, the average amount of time for rainfall to get to the river is 2 hours. So man, and in his effort to develop land and to use it, of course, for crops, for farming, in this case, has totally changed what Mother Nature is doing. And, of course, I just want to recap the past 5 shows. 4 of them I dealt with a special issue of Planet X type objects. And so if you missed that, you certainly want to go back and listen to those shows over the past 5 shows. The third one, or the fourth one, I kind of changed the topic a little bit and then completed the fourth part of that series last week on the 19th of March. So you want to catch those 4 shows. But the point is that no matter when a Planet X type object might come into the solar system, the issue is that we are not living a sustainable lifestyle on this planet. And so that's why we're in trouble. Our banking system is not sustainable. How can you continue to borrow money and have a bank which basically makes it up out of thin air and then creates debt out of that. That's not sound economics. That's like using a credit card, a new credit card, to pay off an old credit card. Not good sound economics, let's put it that way. But be that as it may, the same principle applies to farming or the use of the land in the world. And, of course, they're cutting down the Amazon forests at a tremendous rate. The same thing is happening there. They're going to deplete that land in no time flat. And the corporate farms, the corporate farming practices, the cutting down of forests, vast amounts of forests, the governments allowing business to go in and do this without any repercussions. And, of course, once that rainforest is cut down, it will never come back. That's what the Sahara Desert is. It used to be a large forest. It was cut down basically by the Roman armies to build their fleets of ships. A lot of people don't realize that the Romans had quite a navy going, and of course that wood didn't come from Italy, it came from northern Africa. So the world's resources have been plundered and plundered by Western man and his quest for warfare machinery, and that's where the entire world sits right now. Basically indebted, resource and time-wise and money-wise, to the continual support of warfare. And as I said in the Planet X series, one of the big summarizing points was that man, to survive as a species, has to get off of this planet. And he has to get off in large numbers. So I'll make a mention here just in a second about NASA. Excuse me. Still have that little cough there. But the point is that we have to get off in large numbers, and the space program is not designed to do that. We have to learn how to live in outer space. We have to learn how to grow our food there or propagate food. We have to learn how to take our Earth environment into outer space in large space colonies. And there's nothing like this in sight at NASA. They want to send a man to the moon, then a man to Mars 20 years later. They have the future locked up as far as you can see. And it's a bad idea, it's a bad plan, and it's a huge waste of resources as we dwindle on this Earth with our major resources going asunder to large corporate entities and their greed. The same thing is going to happen someday. The Earth will wake up, the people of the Earth, and they're going to say, we have devastated all of the resources, just like the banking community woke up one day and found that they had loaned and loaned and loaned and made a profit off of every time they wrote up a loan, but they were loaning air, and then finally the whole system collapsed. And of course now they're trying to create money out of thin air to prop up businesses that basically had no resources left at all. And the world is going to wake up, and that's what's going to happen. Right now people, and I predicted this before too, it's actually happening, that with the breakdown of the economy, I would estimate that by this summer, 10% of the United States population will be living in houses that they are not paying for. In other words, they have lost their jobs. They are going to just decide to stay living in their house. They have no place to go. Their family has no place to go. And that is a result of a banking system that has failed. And, of course, Washington keeps talking about, oh, possibly there will be a turnaround by the end of 2010. Or, you know, they're using these future dates, just hoping that people out there will hang on and hope that somehow the government will fix things. Well, at any rate, I'm just going to get back to the topic I started with here, and that is the Himmacane that rolled through the North American continent And of course, I got diverted here as I started talking about the flooding up in places like the Red River Valley due to over-farming, over-tilling the land up there, and going against Mother Nature's design. And of course, after the 1930s, there were laws put into place regarding farming. You had to have soil bank. You had to have a certain amount, as much as 40% of the land had to be just growing naturally, as it would have been, either in forest or typically in grass or some other type of non-productive agricultural land. And they did away with all of that. Corporate farming said, we're going to get the maximum out of this land. And, of course, as I've said before, the entire central part of the United States is one of the most depleted land areas in the world. The only way you can grow crops there, the Frankenstein crops, as I call them, is to have ammonia-based fertilizers and then all kinds of insecticides and chemicals to allow the plants to grow. And they have these huge, beautiful-looking crops. But when they harvest that, they put a big stamp right on the bag where they put the corn or the soybeans. Not fit for human consumption. That's right. So at any rate, this past week, a large himicane, and of course very attributable to the to Venus making its electrical connection to Earth. Now, Venus, inferior conjunction, that means when Venus is directly between us and the Sun, occurs tomorrow on the 27th of March. And so, also along with this, I said we may have a late season flu, and it might be a very unusual flu. Of course, these flu virus germs, if you want to call them that, are being developed in the tail of Venus, and Earth passes through that tail. Now, the medical journals are aware of this, and the Chinese have recorded the flu relative to Venus inferior conjunction going back to 1200 AD. So this is a very well-known effect, so get out your flu medicine. You might be in for a new round here, starting today, tomorrow, anytime in the next week. So at any rate, by the way, on to the next topic. The seed offer, the corn seed offer, is all done. We're all sold out. There's no more left. And so thank you, all of you people who got that last bit of corn seed out there. And I know it's people are following the directions to plant this and then harvest the seed and propagate this species. And just a short review, a year ago, literally about a year ago, possibly a bit more, when the spring flooding began last spring, 2008, I began to investigate the propagation of corn, and what I found was there was a small niche market that was, they were attempting to develop corn and other types of organic seed for the organic chicken market. But the chicken market had made their requirements more stringent, and they didn't want genetically modified organism, GMO type corn or soybeans. And so there was a actually get to this point where they could feed their chickens the non-hybrid, in other words, the original corn seed, it would require a large farming effort and a conversion to farming. So this gets very complicated. And there were some universities working on this. There were Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, the Dakotas, and they were working in conjunction actually with some foreign countries, I won't say where, but to grow seed so that they could then have large fields of corn, soybeans, etc., that would be fed to chickens and other animals, farm animals, so that they would have the original stock of non-genetically modified seed. And so anyway, then come the spring floods of 2008. And as I said, I saw that as weather bombing the crops, and that's exactly what happened. And this is associated once again with the large seed corporations who control. You can't imagine the amount of control, the political control that these companies have. There's just been a flap about legislation coming in that will prevent anybody, including people in their own yard, from growing organic crops. And, of course, there's a huge difference between organic and non-hybrid. Organic simply means that it's grown in a medium that doesn't have chemicals, that uses natural fertilizers. The byproducts of, say, the agricultural product are then tilled back into the soil. That's organic, but there's a whole different topic, and that's the type of seed you use. So there's a lot of organic farmers out there using hybrid seeds, in other words, genetically modified seeds. And so that, to me, is not good. It's really a misuse because everybody thinks, oh, organic is good. Let's take bananas down in the tropics. Very rarely will you ever find anymore any of the original banana plant varieties that grew even 10 years ago. They've all been replaced by the hybrid, the genetically modified brands that have been developed by the large seed corporations. And, of course, the idea is that only they have control over growing the banana crop, as with all of these other crops. So there's a huge problem in the world today, and people don't know it. The fruit that you get, the pears, peaches, plums, nectarines, you name it, apples, all of these are genetically modified. You would be hard-pressed, unless you can go out into the country and find an old apple tree that's been there for decades and decades, and they typically have much smaller apples, not these huge, beautiful ones, that you do get a beautiful-looking apple from this hybrid-type technology, but then you take the seed from that apple, it won't grow another tree and produce more apples. And that's the problem. They've destroyed the genetic seed strains. Remember Johnny Appleseed, the guy that went around planting apples all over the countryside? And now much of his work has been destroyed. And so you are very hard-pressed to find apples that are of the original varieties anymore. And you go to the seed store, they don't even know what you're talking about. If you talked about non-genetically modified seed, they don't even know what you're talking about. These are the experts, the so-called experts in the seed industry. But at any rate, last year I realized this struggling industry had some major failures to grow just the corn seed. And now we're just talking about corn. And so the crop of last summer was a failure before it ever got started. And they had taken pretty much all of the seed stock of this non-genetically modified corn seed that was left and planted it. So it died in the field, let's put it that way, the vast majority of it. I found a place in my calling around and talking to people, and a guy who knew what he was talking about, which is very rare these days, and they had, I won't say where I got it, but they had a small amount left. And when I say small amount, I would say, let's put it this way. Everybody knows what a pallet is. You know, it's the size of your kitchen table or smaller. Stack corn on that up to about 6 feet high. That was it. That was the last remaining corn seed in the world of this genetically unaltered original corn seed stock. And I looked at it and I said, I'm buying it. I said, what's your price? And I just didn't even blink. I bought it and I had it moved to a secure location, and then I started selling it. So I sold it last spring, and then we stopped that offer after the planting season had begun. And then this year we had a little bit left, and so decided to sell that off, and only in the 2,000 seed bags. And so that's all gone. It's all gone, and but here's the situation. It's all over the world now, and this shipped everywhere last spring, and this spring, the little remaining part, we just shipped locally to the United States. But any given person with 2,000 seeds has the ability to repropagate that corn. Now, let me just add this small note here, that you need about 200 corn plants or more to keep the genetic strength of the corn. And so that's all in the instructions that were sent out with the corn seed offer. Everybody that bought the seed got the instructions on how to plant it, how to save the seeds, how to retain the genetic integrity of this corn. But anybody, any one of these people, and that's a lot of people around the world, have the ability to propagate and keep this genetic strain going of the original corn seed, the kind of corn you would have seen on the family farm back in the late 1800s. And now understand that corn developed from the Indian corn, the Native American corn that was here, and of course all over the North and South American continent and Central America, corn was a mainstay crop. So there were many varieties, many, many varieties already of corn that had evolved and had been through natural selection and planting over the centuries, centuries and centuries and centuries, which led up to the corn that was then adopted by the white man, so to speak, when they came to the North American continent, to Central America and South America. And then this evolved into some corns, typically yellow corn. Now, the original corns were all different colors. They were green, they were purple, they were blue, every color you could imagine. But what we ended up with was a yellow corn, and it's called dent corn, basically due to the strength of the material, the kind of the skin that's on the shell of the kernel. And when it dries on the cob, it forms a little dent up on the end, and that's why it's called dent, D-E-N-T, dent corn. So it is a descendant of the original Indian Native American stock that was here before the white man came. And so it evolved up to a fairly stable condition in about the late 1800s. This is the seed that I got my hands on and distributed worldwide. It's also the seed that the Monsantos and the Cargills would try desperately to get rid of, because they want only them to control the corn genetic strain. And of course, they would keep something like this in their own private vaults, but not allow it to be passed out to the public, where it would be grown. And the key issue here is you can grow this corn and then grow it again the next year from the seed you've saved and continue to propagate it in larger and larger numbers. And so anyway, but interestingly enough, Australia would not allow it. Of course, there were many people from Australia who ordered the corn seed, but customs there stopped it, and there was a law in Australia that prevented non-genetically modified, in other words, this type of seed, it prevented people in Australia from getting seed that they could reproduce themselves. So Australia has already had many invasions on in personal freedoms, and of course they are under the Queen over there, and under the Queen there is no personal freedom. The Queen runs everything. That's why we got rid of those lousy, crummy Queen King things in this country. That's why this country was founded. We got rid of the Queen. We don't like the Queen, and a lot of people in those other countries don't like the Queen. And you have to understand, the Queen derives her power from all the gold that was stolen from South America. They were nothing. They were a little island in the North Sea off of Europe until they were able to get over to the New World and rip off all of the gold from South America. And of course, when the HMS Victory was discovered in the middle of the English Channel, I made the comment that as soon as it was discovered with 400 tons of gold on it, the English made claim to the gold. Well, how could they make claim to gold that was stolen from someone else? Well, that's history. And that's what gives the Queen her power. A lot of people wonder that. What gives this woman so much power? Well, it's like part of the Rothschild house. They have cornered the world gold and precious metals and then also a lot of the properties around the world. And they corner this, and there was the statement that the sun never sets on the English Empire. But that's because of the vast navy and that they built because of the gold they stole from South and Latin America after the discovery down there. But at any rate, this is kind of getting somewhere off track, but this also gives you a little bit of insight into why these groups now hold such control. And as I said, Australia would not allow the seed to enter their country and destroyed it all. So, unfortunately, that's one place that was not allowed. But it also shows you the control that the seed companies are starting to get over governments, and they're going to try this ploy. This will come out soon, that if anybody's growing anything organic, then there's the possibility of disease growing and ruining all the crops that we need to feed the populations of the world, which are, of course, grown by Monsanto and ADM and Cargill's, etc. So you see, there's going to be a political, a legal fight, and possibly even a physical fight over the ability of people to grow their own food in their own yard using organic, non-hybrid seeds. Get ready for that one. That's on the way. Okay, so at any rate, the seed offer is done. It's all over, and I hope that in the future. Now, just one last quick note, and this is to the Cargill ADM clowns out there that think they're going to control the world food supply. If we ever have a natural disaster of a worldwide scale, I mean, whether an asteroid would hit Earth or a Planet X type object comes in and destroys the infrastructure, or if we had, say, a major solar flare that broke down, say, the electrical grid system all around the world to where, say, farming and agriculture would be shut down for just 1 year, all of the seed stock of the ADMs and the Cargills, all of that would be lost. It would all go away. And after 2 or 3 years, there would only be, all those hybrids would die off, because the whole point is that they don't generate any future seed. And of course, they grow their seed in specially designed agricultural plots all over the world to produce the seed then that farmers have to buy, because they hold the monopoly. They hold the seed, and the farmers can't save seed from the last year, because that's the whole point of hybrid. They grow a healthier crop, supposedly, more resistant, but the seed cannot be used to replant the next year. The catch-22 on that for the Monsantos and the ADMs of the world is that if we have a natural catastrophe on this planet of worldwide scope, then all of the genetically modified crops will simply go away, because they can't sustain that level of production and transportation and everything that has to go into supporting that industry. So they will simply go away, and the only people that will be able to eat will be the people who actually were smart enough to get a hold of non-genetically modified seed, learn how to plant it and save it, and we're already in that cycle. Okay, on to a quick announcement. This summer, 2009, get ready, fasten your seatbelts, because NASA, that big disinformation machine, and a lot of its disinformation crew, which are out there, they're going to now understand that July 2009 will be the 40th anniversary of NASA allegedly going to the moon. Now, there's going to be a lot of fanfare. I've already found out that the majority of people in Japan don't believe NASA ever went to the moon. In fact, I know for a fact that all the Russian scientists don't. They don't even consider it, because Russia had its own space program and knew of the difficulties of getting through the Van Allen Belt. Now, there's a lot of issues involved here, and I personally don't gain anything from talking about this, because it's really a topic that NASA should be settling on its own. And here's what has to happen. There has to be third-party verification that NASA went to the moon. It's very simple. It's not about pictures. It's not about... There's a lot of phony baloney if you look at all of the images and the information that NASA put out during the moon landing period. And I was in college during those years in physics, so I was very interested, followed it all. I had all the manuals for the Saturn V and the lunar lander. We had those at the school where I went and was taking physics courses. And that, you know, that's just a side note here. I get a kick out of a lot of the clowns that NASA puts out there trying to defend the moon landing, and they weren't even born. These clowns weren't even born in 1969. So, you know, it's not exactly like they got first-hand information, if you know what I mean. It's really kind of a joke, but NASA is taking this very seriously, and this summer, from about April to July, you are going to be barraged, and of course, that's why people listen to this show. I can look at the trends and give you information before anybody else sees it or gives it out, and then I can interpret it for you, so that you understand the clouds of BS, so to speak, that will surround this. But NASA is going to put a tremendous amount of politicizing and information and disinformation out, just to make it sound like they were on the moon in all those six times, Apollo 11, 12, of course 13 had some problems, allegedly, and then up to Apollo 17, I believe. So it'd be 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17. And then they canceled, magically, the last landings. The last three landings that were supposed to occur in the kind of the mid-70s, NASA just canceled them, took down, dismantled the entire Saturn V program, and just took everything and dismantled everything and took a few pieces, put them in the Smithsonian Museum, and that was it. Now, very interestingly, a whole new barrage of information that allegedly NASA has had in archives for 40 years, pictures of the moon landing, all kinds of pictures that we have never seen before, are now being posted on NASA and NASA-related web pages. This is mainly being done out of the University of Arizona. Another great place that NASA has used repeatedly for misinformation. Some of my best enemies are at the University of Arizona. Some of the people that have worked overtime trying to keep my work from getting to the public are from the University of Arizona. And so at any rate, I find it interesting that NASA's using the University of Arizona to process these pictures. And now, let me give you an example. They have allegedly rolls and rolls and rolls of pictures taken by Hasselblad cameras. Those are those great European cameras of rocks and lunar soil and the astronauts standing on the ledge of a with the lunar rover out there, and I often wondered, how did they take this picture? Because the two astronauts are out there by the rover, and here's the camera, you know, a few hundred yards away. But be that as it may, every time they release something, it brings up more interesting questions. But that's not the point is that you are going to be barraged by NASA's new wave of just planned information or misinformation, whatever you want to call it, regarding the moon landing, because they need a good showing this July. And also, now, the thing I have been crying out for years is that there has to be, there's probably seven satellites orbiting the moon from various countries that are taking high-resolution pictures of the lunar surface. Nobody has come up with a picture of the Apollo lunar landing sites, and we all know where they are. It's public information. And so why would these outfits not spend a little extra time when they're over those sites and take a picture and say, there it is, you know, there's Apollo 11, there's Apollo 12. None of them have done that. But now, extending this idea, in 2008, NASA had a satellite called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, LRO. And it had a camera on it, and it was supposed to be launched in 2008. Well, they put it on the back shelf, and now they're going to launch it in April of 2009. And one of the scientific objectives, although not a major scientific objective, of the LRO is to take pictures of the Apollo landing sites. And, of course, now look at the timing of this. It was supposed to go up in 2008. It's going to go up in April, and so the pictures NASA is going to start to release just around the time of July, where all of this fanfare is going to happen. NASA will have total control of the press, and nobody else will get a chance to look at these until NASA releases their pet photos. Now, look at the incentive for NASA to fake these photos, to Photoshop in a lunar lander or something. The point is, we need third-party independent verification that there is equipment, the Apollo landers, the Apollo lunar rovers that are supposedly on the moon. We need that independently verified by someone else, not NASA. NASA has a huge incentive to fake all of this. And, of course, they have much better ability now to fake it than they did in 1969. Do we trust NASA? Ask me if I trust NASA. No, I don't trust them. I don't trust the people they pay, their outreach people. They are all a bunch of paid. So on to the next topic. Tsunamis in the Caribbean. This is an article that came out in one of the science newspapers that I get regularly. There are islands in the Caribbean, let me just name them off. Of course, there have been some serious volcanoes down there recently, but Dominica, as it's pronounced, and then Guadeloupe, in that area of the Lesser Antilles, those are the islands that are down, arcing down towards Venezuela, about a third of the way down from Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico. They're about a third of the way down in that arc of the islands out in the Caribbean, very volcanic islands. And here's what happens. They develop lava shields. And here's what happens when a volcano erupts and the lava flows down the side of the mountain. You can imagine that the new lava is sitting as a layer on top of the old lava. But, of course, the old lava had its surface weathered. There was rain. There was weathering going on. And so when the new lava sheet comes down, there's a separation. There's kind of a viscous layer there. Okay, this keeps layering up and layering up. And then eventually the gravitational pull of on these shelves causes them to break off and then slide down like a toboggan into the ocean. And this has happened many times. You can see throughout the tropical islands that this has happened many, many times in many different places. But these regions of the Caribbean are now subject to this type of landslide, volcanic landslide, and tsunamis, which could then propagate anywhere up to as far up as Florida or other places. Once these waves, these water waves, are generated, they can go literally around the world until they hit a land mass. So you're looking at Mexico, the Gulf area, possibly, potentially, the eastern seaboard, the islands like the Bahamas, etc., could be in the path of these tsunamis. And these are real threats. These are real conditions. Just one more note quickly on the Chinese drywall situation. Of course, you've all heard about that. Tens of thousands of homes built with drywall from China that had high sulfur content, turning the copper black in the electrical wiring in these houses. And, of course, what happens when moisture mixes with that sulfur, it turns into sulfuric acid. So people are breathing this in their houses, sulfuric acid coming out of the walls of these houses. And as I said before, I wouldn't build a new house today, even if you could, the housing industry here is dead, not only because of the financial reasons, but because now all of the parts, the light fixtures, the switches, the wiring, the sheetrock, all comes from China, and there's no quality control on this. And this is the kind of thing that happens when American greed and businessmen get in the way. I'll leave this topic about birds until next week, the declining bird population. Well, let me just quick put it in here. There's a study that just came out recently dealing with bird populations declining tremendously over the past couple decades. Something I didn't know, one-third of all U.S. bird species are in Hawaii. But little islands out there, you would think, maybe you'd have, 20 or 30 species of birds. One-third of all species of birds in the United States are in that little island country. And it's under a tremendous amount of stress because of basically destruction of habitat. But at any rate, the worldwide situation, and these, we're talking about small birds, typically, but it's mainly a situation of habitat. So I would encourage people to understand what kind of birds are in your area, what kind of birds were in your area, and create and leave habitat. Don't pick up all of those branches and things out in the woods behind your house. Leave them lay there. That's habitat for little animals, for plants that the birds feed on, etc. So learn about birds in your area and create habitat. That's part of sustaining our planet. On to the topic of general relativity. And I'm sorry I got a bit long-winded on some of these other topics today. But let me talk about general relativity. And as you'll see, this does affect the average person on the street. In 1911 was the official release, just 6 years after Einstein printed or published his special relativity papers. He advanced a theory called general relativity, dealing with gravity and the potential for gravity to affect electromagnetic radiation. And basically what it amounted to was that any time you had a gravitational object, like the sun or the earth, but mainly dealing with the big objects, the big stellar objects in the universe, the galactic nuclei, the other large objects, they would bend space around them. And so things happened a little bit differently than you would expect in Newtonian physics. And of course, Newton dealt with space as if it were three-dimensional, and all of the laws of physics, the laws of gravitation had been fairly well established, but there were some discrepancies. For example, Mercury didn't move in its orbit quite the way gravitational Newtonian gravitation would predict. And these scientists back then were very stringent, very hardcore scientists. They were very good. They didn't have modern computers to deal with, so they did all their calculations by hand. And it's something that's kind of been lost, unfortunately. But that's another story. But around 1911, Einstein published his first major paper on general relativity. And it had already predicted or accounted for the odd orbital characteristics of the planet Mercury fairly accurately. And so now he was saying that there was a possibility that because of the curved space around these massive stellar objects, that there would be bending of light around the sun. And so a couple of guys, major scientific entities at that time, one of them named Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington, who was a prominent astronomer in England, and another guy, also from England, Frank Watson Dyson. These two got their heads together and realized Dyson was an expert in eclipses, predicting where eclipses would be and their properties and etc. So he understood that in the year 1919, a number of years down the road from the point they were at, apparently Einstein had been in communication with leading astronomers as early as 1913, that they could do this type of experiment, but they needed a total solar eclipse. And basically, here's how it works. You take a picture of the sky where the star patterns in the sky. You take that with a telescope, and then you take the picture of the sky at the later when the total eclipse of the sun is occurring, but the sun, of course, the moon is blocking out the light from the sun. And that's another kind of an odd thing. Our moon is exactly the right size so that when you're standing on the surface of the Earth, it exactly blocks out the entire disk of the sun. Now, what's the probability that that's going to happen in an average solar system? Pretty unusual. But at any rate, excuse me, our moon has that unusual property. So that means during a total eclipse, you basically have a disk out in space, our moon, which completely, 100%, blocks the disk of the sun, causing a total blackout if you're in the proper path of the total solar eclipse. And so the point of the experiment was to go to a location, and this turned out to be down in the tropics in Africa and off a little island off of Africa at the time, to be exactly in the path of the total solar eclipse and then take a picture of the sun, of course, being blocked out by the moon, and then the star pattern in the background that you've already taken a picture of from another point in time, and then compare them. And the idea of general relativity, if there's bending of light around the sun, then the stars should move outwards in your picture when the sun is between you and the stars, which, of course, the stars are very far away. But it turns out to be an extremely complicated experiment with many factors that the average person would just not be aware of. For example, some stars move on a yearly basis back and forth because they're close to us and they seem to move back and forth. It's called parallax. There's all of these subtle little effects that can affect, in fact, just the properties of the telescopes. Say that the day you took the picture of the sky without the sun, you took that star pattern picture, and then you go to the tropics with the same telescope and take a picture, if the magnification of the telescope has changed or altered, or if the temperature is even different, that telescope is going to respond differently. So they had to take all of this into account. Very complicated experiment, especially for the time. They didn't get on a jet and fly down there. They had to load their equipment on a ship, get to the proper location, set up their equipment, and then hope for good weather. And so they were also plagued by bad weather, but they accomplished what they set out for to do, and that was to take these photographic plates of, and in fact, for the best they could determine at the time, was that Einstein's general theory of relativity, which predicted bending of light around the sun, it predicted a certain amount of bending, and the experiments seemed to bear this out with relative precision. And in 1979, some astronomers took out the old plates, went through the same calculations as if they were doing it for the first time, excuse me, and came to pretty much the same conclusion. Now, let's enter the modern age. Just as with one might expect, 1979, I happened to be at Cornell University, and one day I went to a meeting which was being held at Cornell. Many of the faculty, the astrophysics, the space science, the astronomers were all there. It was quite an interesting meeting, and they were discussing some new data that had just come in. Now, here's what happened. Venus had a satellite around it. It was one of the Venus orbiter satellites, one of the early ones, and they had taken data. Now, Venus, of course, passes around behind the sun. And so the radio signals from that satellite were on a very known, well-known path because of the orbit of Venus and because of the satellite being around Venus, orbiting Venus. As Venus passed behind the sun in its orbit, and as we looked at that satellite from Earth and picked up the radio signal, there was a very unique opportunity to do an experiment. And that experiment was to try to verify Einstein's relativity using radio waves, because they act just like the light from coming from stars. That's electromagnetic radiation. And in the meeting, they showed the data. The data was very erratic. The bending of the radio waves around the sun was very erratic. It didn't follow any kind of pattern, and the entire meeting broke down into discussions of how they could reconcile the data with general relativity. And there was never any conclusion. The data was scrapped. Everybody went away. And to me, I was like thinking, here is data in 1979 in front of all of these scientists at Cornell University, astronomers, astrophysicists, space scientists, physicists, all of them fully familiar with general relativity, all of the predictions, all of the work that had been done over the years regarding black holes and bending of space-time, etc., etc., etc. Here are all these people sitting in a room looking at data that conclusively disproves general relativity, and they all walk away and drop it like a lead balloon. This is what I wanted to talk about tonight. And, of course, at the time, I had proposed a new concept dealing with the electrical conditions in the solar system and around fusion-type objects. I already knew that the fusion in stars didn't occur in the center of the star. It occurred up at the surface of the stars, and that's what created the non-uniform electric fields, the non-uniform flow of protons in the solar wind, which created the capacitor, and that's what caused the comets to work. Now, look around the sun, and you have that same but much more intense non-uniform electric field. And that is what was causing the bending of light. And of course it was very erratic, because when you looked at the sun on a very short scale, as you would with the Venus orbiter that's going around now behind the sun, you would see this very short-term erratic behavior because the electric field near the sun is very rapidly changing due to the surface fusion process, which is very rapidly changing very near the surface. And, of course, that smooths out as you get out farther away from the sun. But once again, here I am in 1979 sitting in a room with the world's top astrophysicists, physicists, space scientists, and astronomers looking at data that conclusively disproves general relativity, and not a single one of them had the kahunas to stand up and say, general relativity is wrong, we got to start looking someplace else. The political death of that person, the scientific end of his career, could have come from saying that. So they all went away and didn't say a word. And so recently, the reason I'm bringing all of this up is recently there have been articles trying to substantiate the experiments that were done in 1919, the famous Eddington and Dyson experiments to prove general relativity. Since then, very little, if anything, has been done to verify general relativity. It's a very difficult experiment because you cannot get massive objects in your laboratory. So at any rate, then one might say, well, what about the orbit of Mercury? How do you account for the precession of the orbit of Mercury? That also is accountable due to the electrical conditions around the sun, because the tail drag, which is the same effect that actually Earth experiences, all of the planets experience, but mainly comets experience, and we see this in large comets. The tail drag is what causes the electrical charging of Mercury, and then the tail drag is what causes the precession of Mercury's orbit. Excuse me. So you see that the replacement of general relativity is very important. The whole idea of the expanding universe, black holes, all of these topics which are now very much ingrained in the popular science, so that the public believes all these phenomenal, you know, amazing, but really untrue scientific principles, all of this relates back to the political situation in science. So for somebody to stand up and say general relativity is wrong would be quite an amazing statement today. But let's look at what Einstein said himself. And you can get this book, it's available to the public. It's a book by Einstein called Out of My Later Years, and it's kind of a brief summary of his life as he looked back when he was quite an old man, just before he died. And he has a paragraph in there where he discusses general relativity. And he basically states that he never believed general relativity because it did not include the electromagnetic fields. How could gravity affect photons of light when there was no theory for electromagnetism in a star to affect it? So at any rate, that's just a short summary of the issues going on with general relativity today, but very important because it comes back to the issues on planet Earth relative to the electrical nature of our solar system, our weather, the comet activity, Planet X, etc., etc. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.